please continue with your lunch, but we want to get started with the program so you get a full dose of Mr. McCann and you also have a chance to ask questions. We're fortunate today to have Al McQuinn as the introducer of our speaker. Al is a new member of the Forum Club who made arrangements for Mr. McCann to be here. So, Al, if you would you introduce our speaker? Thank you.
Thank you, Wally. I accept that credit, but I'm not sure that it's appropriate because I made a mention to my Merrill Lynch representative group as to the benefits that I could derive if I were to obtain a speaker. And I mentioned it a couple of times and really didn't think too much would come of it, but the next thing I know, back comes the word that, by the way, the vice chairman of Merrill Lynch is looking at the possibility of accepting this invitation. And I want to represent the three people that really had more to do with that than I ever did, because I think they have that recognition coming. Doug King is a director of the Minneapolis Complex here. Biff Robillard, who I go back a long time with his family, his father and his mother, and he is a resident director of the Wayzata operation. And then my very good friend and conspirator in what we do with Merrill Lynch, which is option trading, we have a hoot of a good time together in doing what we do. And so that's Chris Erickson, and he just stood up back here. And then, you know, I didn't meet Bob McCann. I read his bio, as you did. I asked a lot of questions about him, and you know, you can draw some conclusions, but I think the conclusion that means the most to me and doesn't surprise me that I drew in visiting with Bob in the last hour is the fact that he's a real person, like so many of us. He's not floating off out here out of reach of an ordinary person. And he's easy to talk to. He remembers his roots. He talked about that to me. And I think he's a wonderful person. Well, that sets being the leader, one of the top leaders in Merrill Lynch, that tends to set the culture of a company. And I've dealt with quite a few of them, not just investment companies, but in my real life, going through OEM suppliers and dealing with people, tremendous difference of the culture that comes down. The culture that as a CEO of my company, I tried to set in my company was that of being open, knowing who my customers were, and being a human being to them when they were in need or when they wanted to reach out. And that's the kind of experience that I've had and of having with Merrill Lynch. Now, that gets mighty close to some kind of a recommendation or some kind of a tribute, and maybe it is. But I really find that that comes down through the three gentlemen that I introduced to you and the kind of relationship that I experienced with Merrill Lynch. And so after meeting Bob McCann and visiting with him, I understand that that comes down from way up in the company and from the top in this case. It is my pleasure today to introduce Bob McCann. You have his bio on the Forum Club sheet, And if you don't have one, if you've lost it and you want to pick one up, there were some out on the table out front. You can pick one up on the way out. And with that, Bob has some, what I believe will be some very interesting things to say to you, and I don't want to keep you from that anymore. So, Bob McCann.
Good afternoon, everybody. Come on, energy here. I'm the one that flew from New York today. I have to make some casual observations at the beginning. Any club that makes liberal use of a gavel and says a prayer to start their meeting, I'll be back. I feel a certain amount of pressure being up here today. Al described me as a human being. Try not to let you down on that. Father Ted, I have some issues with you. Reverend Ted, I'd like to point out. Let's remember, there's no honorarium, as people have pointed out. You put this certain pressure on me of talking about my intelligence, my oratory skills, and the good sense to keep people on time. I'll do my best, sir. Did anybody but me notice that Wally Abbott is gleeful to be handing over the gavel? Thank you for being here today. Thank you for inviting me. I jumped at the opportunity to speak to this group when I understood exactly who and what you were and the role that you play in your community. All of you have your own individual successes, your stories of your life professionally and personally, how you got to where you are. But one of the things that I'm most impressed by was symbolized by the fact that these students are here with us today, that you are not just spending time in Naples, you are an important part of the community here, and you care about the future of this community. I love quotes. I like to find interesting quotes. And I saw one about a month ago that I tucked away and wanted to use today, and that's from the American writer and futurist Alvin Toffler, that he said that the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who can't read and write, but those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn. I love that quote. This club, the Forum Club, understands that as well as any group that I could think of. And the fact that you bring in leaders from different walks of life, because you are a group that is constantly thirsting, even today, to learn new and different things. Sam Nunn, Ann Mulcahy, who I have a great deal of respect for, we've had speak at several Merrill Lynch meetings, Alan Simpson, and then for a boy who grew up in Western Pennsylvania, Joe Paterno, to name a few. I couldn't be happier or more proud to be with such an esteemed group. I also want to embarrass somebody, one of your members. Bill Hoagland is here. He got mentioned earlier. I work for one of the most demanding, intelligent men on Wall Street, Stan O'Neill. My uncle, Rube Jensen, worked for a long time at General Motors, and he worked with Bill, and Stan worked for him. I need some insight a little later. I admire, though, the group of people that are here today, your commitment to learning and education, and it extends to the next generation. We think we stand for that at Merrill Lynch as well. For the students that are here, you got to practice for your graduation today, and I look forward to your questions and the chance to interact afterwards. Before we do that, though, I thought I would share some of my thoughts about Merrill Lynch and the markets, what we see in the economies right now, how I think about investing. At Merrill Lynch, we have a proud history, and we think we have a very bright future. We are truly a global organization. Somebody asked me how long I've worked at Merrill Lynch. It will be 25 years this July 6th. I've been there my entire adult life, literally. We're very proud that we're known as the firm that brought Wall Street to Main Street. We have 3 million individual investor clients, and those clients give us great trust. They entrust us with $1.6 trillion of their assets. We've also built a very successful ultra-high net worth business where we have over $580 billion in client assets with clients who have at least $10 million with us. We have a leading investment banking and global markets business. And finally, we own half of BlackRock, a trillion-dollar publicly traded investment management company. So we're big, we're global, and most of all, what we're most proud of is our history of focusing on clients. Size is important in our business. Global reach and scale are important in our business as it is in many of your businesses. But in the end, our real strength is people. It's the talented, innovative people, advisors, who are meeting and in many cases exceeding the growing complex needs of today's most sophisticated investors. And like you, we take great pride in being active in the communities that we serve at Merrill Lynch. One final admission I'll make to you on a personal basis is I am one of the few Merrill Lynch executives who does not own a home in Naples. Yet. And at 6 o'clock this morning, my wife did point out certain things to me, and she's harder on me than Reverend Ted is. In addition, like you, we are trying to read an economy that we feel certainly is sending out mixed signals and adjust to a constantly changing business environment. And we are working to understand what it takes to be a leader. I don't know this organization well. I got into town an hour and 20 minutes ago. But I know I am in a room filled with leaders. We think about that a lot. I think that about that a lot personally. What it takes to be a leader and sustain leadership in today's world over the long term. Talk a little bit about the economy. From my vantage point, the most important development in the economy of the last 20 years has been the accelerating globalization of the capital markets. Globalization is no longer a matter of whether or when, but how fast. It is happening. Virtually every nation in the world, to a greater or lesser degree, has adopted aspects of a free market economy. Look at China, Russia, India, Argentina. Different cultures, different continents. They have different forms of government. But each of them practice capitalism. It may be different forms, but they, at their core now, are capitalists. They share a participation in the world economy, and they are experiencing dramatic growth. Wealth is being created, and eventually liquidity accumulates, often more than can be absorbed into their markets domestically. That liquidity reappears in the marketplace looking for the best opportunities. Across Asia, the Pacific Rim, North America, Europe, Eastern Europe, Latin America, all nations of the world have an opportunity to contribute and compete for the world's resources. Let me give you a few numbers that I think illustrate the impact of this on a global basis. 1980, not all that long ago, the total value of the world's financial assets was $12 trillion. By 2004, it was $120 trillion. By 2010, global financial assets are estimated to be at $200 trillion. Another way to look at the development of the financial markets, and why I think this is such a big development in our history, is to look at the world's financial assets as a percentage of global gross domestic product. 1980, financial assets were roughly the same size as global GDP. By 2003, financial assets were more than three times global GDP. That means more and more of the world's overall wealth is being held and channeled through the capital markets. Liquidity is constantly flowing, and the benefits of free markets are evident. Around the world, millions and millions of people are rising out of poverty. maybe not as many as we'd like, and maybe not as fast, but people are rising out of poverty and improving their lives. NAFTA fosters an interdependence of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. It has contributed to the overall economic success of all three trading partners. Same thing happening in Asia. I will be in Japan and Hong Kong next week. You look at China, Japan, Singapore. These are nations with long and complex histories. And if you're a student of history, you'll know that they are largely defined by aggression and distrust. But now, these countries are more bound than they have ever been through mutual economic interests. The globalization of the capital markets has become one of the leading forces for stability in the world today, improving not merely economic relations, but also impacting geopolitical relationships. When you stand back and you look at these developments from 50,000 feet, the prospects for the global economy, mid to long range, are incredible. In fact, I would argue historic. The global marketplace is more diverse and more complex than ever before. At Merrill Lynch, we would like to think we understand that, and we have been investing significantly across our business to make sure our clients can capitalize on this unprecedented set of opportunities. For example, giving our high net worth individual clients access to our proprietary private equity business, developing a unified managed account, giving the individual investor access to true institutional managers like Wellington. We've been constantly and continually investing in our people. And today, our private banking group, I'm very proud to say, in my opinion, has some of the smartest, most accomplished wealth strategists, many with over 20 years of experience, legal backgrounds, CPAs, financial planners in the world. Last year, we began what we call Financial Boot Camp to help educate our clients' children about financial and estate planning. It's a big concern with many of our clients who have had success. Will the next generation appreciate what it took to have that success, and will they know how to use it? The program has been a tremendous success, and this year we're going to be hosting three boot camps at Wharton, the University of Chicago, and UCLA to continue educating this important group of people. These are only a few examples. I could talk about more. But what about the near-term economy? I talked about the mid to long-term. What about the near-term? Frankly, we find it hard to read right now. If you go back 5 or 6 years, in the fall of 2001, we actually had a very clear view. We felt very strongly that we were in for much more difficult times, and it turned out we were right. By 2003, the middle of 2003, we had changed, and we started to invest in our company, our business, and our clients for what we were confident was going to be better times and an improving economy. Now, though, I frankly find the near term a little bit more difficult to predict. Some indications are certainly positive. There were some good economic numbers this morning in the market. The equity market is strong again. As a consequence of globalization, clearly markets are more transparent, more liquid than they've ever been. And with the proliferation of products and investment opportunities, we still continue to see an extraordinary accumulation of wealth worldwide if you take a long-term view. So, does this mean that we think it's all blue skies ahead? No. I actually think there are a number of challenges on the horizon as well. The biggest concerns that I think about and focus on are geopolitical uncertainty. I turned to Wally as we were talking over lunch, and he asked me how long I had lived in the New York area, and I said 25 years ago I moved there for 2 years. And for the first 20 years, the truth of the matter is, if you'd have met me and I'd have told you I moved to New York for business reasons, and I would have said it's a nice place, but I'm here because of the job I have. 9/11 changed that for me. I love New York. I'm from Pittsburgh originally, but I love New Yorkers and what that city stands for. Despite that, though, a second area of concern that I have is this rising tide of protectionist sentiment in the United States and elsewhere. I'm a free markets person, I'll admit that. I don't think I'm in the minority in this room if I had to guess. But I worry about also a shock to the system, North Korea, Iran, There are a lot of scary possibilities in the world we live in. Even the stock market drop that we experienced in late February is an important reminder that we need to keep things in perspective. Again, my opinion only. I believe that that sell-off, that volatility in the market is actually healthy. It's good for the market long term. The equity markets had experienced almost an uninterrupted gain for a number of years. The stock exchange, New York Stock Exchange Index, had been up 20% since July. Volatility had been extremely low, and we had not seen a pullback of any magnitude for 4 years. You're all seasoned people. That's not reality. The return of some volatility, and I'll show you just a couple of slides, is actually a return to what's normal, what's healthy. You don't have to all pull it out, but in the little folder that we left in your desk, there is a couple of slides if you want to look at it. Behind the cover slide, there's a slide that's titled CBOE Volatility Index, VIX, and I promise I will keep the Wall Street terminology to a minimum. You have my word. But I did grow up in investment banking, and I can't go out unescorted without a couple of slides. VIX reflects a measure or an estimate of future stock market volatility. It's also a measure of investor sentiment. And if you see that slide in there, what you'll show is that you saw that big spike on February 27th, a violent spike. But if you also look at that slide, what you'll see is that spike wasn't to unusually high levels. Now, I've been in the investment business for a long time. You likely have been students of the market for a long time. At Merrill Lynch, we have always felt that if you're properly positioned, you have the right asset allocation, understand your risk and where you are, that dislocations like that can create long-term opportunities. At Merrill Lynch, our outlook in terms of the economy here over the near term is we think that there's going to be a softer U.S. economy, but not a recession. We think many of the international economies will actually be stronger than the U.S. One important example I would point to is Japan. We think what's going on in Japan is both significant and sustainable. And we think we'll have volatility more similar to typical volatility than what we had seen in several years. There are also still risks in the market. Even after the market has healed here and we've had some strength, we see continued risk in the market. Now, in the world we live in, the CNBC world, where it's all information all the time, whether it's important or not, you hear a lot about credit. Let's talk a little bit about credit. You've obviously had an incredible hot real estate market in Florida, generally in Naples, for a number of years. I have two slides in there about credit and risk in the market. Slide number three is a slide that shows high yield or junk bond issuance. And I think this is an important slide as you think about investing in your own. Slide shows the quantity and quality of high yield or junk bond issuance. The amount of junk bond issuance is actually hitting record highs, the amount. And at the same time, the quality of the issuance is at all-time lows. If you look on that bar graph, there's an orange part of the bar. There are triple C bonds, the riskiest, the poorest credit quality. And you can see that section of the market is growing. So at the very time that you're late in the credit cycle, you have poor quality bonds being issued more and more. Watch that as an investor. The next slide, the fourth slide and last slide, is the distress ratio, which it's very simple, but I think it's an effective metric. It shows the percentage of junk bonds that are trading 1,000 or more basis points over treasuries, true distressed bonds. As you can see, we're at an all-time low on the distressed ratio. Does that make sense? No, there's been too much capital chasing too few opportunities in the market. That's part of what you see going on in the mortgage market. People were given loans, took out loans, the type of loan, very few fixed rate, variable rate mortgages, they carry a higher risk, and you have this excess in the market, and that's what's playing out. The permeating fear among investors is this fallout is going to cause a sudden plunge in the economy or in other certain sectors of the economy. We don't agree with that. At Merrill Lynch, our work would indicate that this is going to be more played out. This was an excess that was not built overnight, and the correction of the excess will not happen or occur overnight as well. We're at a time of transition in the markets and the economy. That's what's really going on. I think that it's times like these fork in the road times, when it's actually most important to have an advisor, a financial advisor that you trust. Somebody who understands what's going on in the marketplace, but equally understands what's going on with you, how you think about investments, about risk, and can take their knowledge of you and their knowledge of the market and bring them together and allow you and work with you to discuss a long-term strategy. At Merrill Lynch, I'm proud of many things, but I'm most proud of our financial advisors. We think that we have built a business and a platform that allows these talented people to capitalize on a wide range of opportunities, not merely here in the United States, but we can get our advisors the best investment products that allow their clients to participate in any market in the world during any type of investment cycle. We continue to invest in our company, and that's good for us as a company, it's good for our shareholders, but I would argue it's good for you, our clients, as well. We've done over 30 acquisitions in the last 3 years, as a matter of fact. And by any measure, 2006 was the most successful year that our company has ever had. We believe, though, that in the end, it takes your success for us to be successful, that we create value for ourselves by creating value for our clients. Their success will fuel our growth as a company. That's how we position ourselves as a company. I'm proud of Merrill. I'm proud of our people. And I might have to ask you to forgive me for that if it comes on too strong at times. We'd like to think we're the best. But being the best has its own challenges as well. You have to keep innovating, learning, growing, and you never can be satisfied. That drive and commitment needs to be baked into the culture of your organization. It was nice what Al has observed about our culture. It makes me happy to hear that. And that creating of a culture, leaders define a culture, is very important to me. I spend a lot of time thinking about that, and I've learned a lot about it from Stan. It's an obligation of a leader to make an organization, whether it's Merrill Lynch or the Forum Club. And I just met Wally today, but my sense is you've made this a better organization, sir. Leadership, though, isn't about an individual. It's about a team. At Merrill Lynch, I'm very proud to be part of what I think is a very deep and talented team, and that's very true of my colleagues who are here with me today. And there are too many to mention by name, but I will mention one. A part of our culture at Merrill Lynch is realizing that while you need to have confidence and you need to have a strong self-image, you realize that you are merely the next generation of leader at Merrill Lynch. And there's a gentleman, Bob Sherman, who's here with us, who I'm embarrassing right now, but I don't care because Bob Sherman played a senior role in our company for many years. And myself and Stan and people like us in private client locally or around the world, we realize that we're just part of a long history at Merrill Lynch, and we try and make sure that we take what people like Bob Sherman did and build on it and make it better when we leave it than when we found it. You can learn a lot about a person by reading their bio. Al mentioned that earlier. I read his bio too. Al has been married to his wife, Mary Agnes, for 52 years, and that's in his bio. Mary Agnes isn't here with us today, but my favorite aunt is Mary Agnes. And when your last name's McCann and the guy who introduces you to McQuinn, and he's been married to the same woman for 52 years, and he has the same name as your favorite aunt, McQuinn, you're okay. Thank you. Thank you for your time today. It was nice to be with you.
What a wonderful cleanup hitter for our season. Al McQuinn now has a stack of questions that goes on and on. He'll address some of them. If you have a question that doesn't get addressed, come up afterwards and give Mr. McCann a chance to do it. We've got a couple of books that we're going to give to him to take back to New York to his wife in the hopes that they entice them to Naples at some time. Naples and Marco Island. Bob, thank you. Al?
Wow. You know, this is my first time, of course, that I've ever had to go through these questions like this, but these are thoughtful questions, and it's hard to sort through. So if I don't get to your question, don't be surprised, because the competition's pretty heavy. What strategies would you, and this is a student question, what strategies would you offer to a young looking to take a position in the stock market?
Young investor?
An investor, I guess.
First of all, is this on? Can you hear on this one?
Let's see.
You can hear? Okay. First of all, I think if this is one of the students that asked it, and I guess it is, I think there is no better way to learn about investing in the stock market than by getting some money together to be able to buy some individual stocks. And it really doesn't matter how much. If it's one share or two shares, if it's just an odd lot, and you put together a little portfolio, and you pick those stocks yourself, or you work with an advisor to pick them, so that you learn what the difference between a good company and a good stock. And you do some research on the companies, and you follow it. And it gives you a reason to pick up the Wall Street Journal or your local paper every day and to read about those companies. I would also say that I think it's always good to pick a local company to invest in when you're a young student, because that's in your neighborhood and you can see it and maybe get to know some of the people that work there. When I was in graduate school, I went to graduate school in Texas at Texas Christian, and the best class I ever took was something called the Educational Investment Fund. And we had a real portfolio with real money that we managed. And somebody was good enough to give that money to TCU many years earlier, and it was our job. You took a class and you picked real stocks, and it's a lot different than a paper portfolio. So even if you have $500 or $600 and you're buying one share of this and one share of that, it's a great way to learn about investing.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I'm going to do another student question. How do you feel the U.S. should orient itself in the face of competition from global emerging free market economies?
Yeah.
They're thinkers.
You know, I never got a scholarship, by the way, so I have my kids up here starting. I am a free markets person, and I always have been. And as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, I actually find it an issue of concern that whenever we put up barriers, because I think over the long haul it creates inefficiencies. I believe in a global economy. By the way, when I say these things back home in Pittsburgh, my father, whose name is Bob McCann, so he can't totally get away from me, but he kind of shrinks to the other side of the room. He was a union man. But so that's my background. But my belief and my business experience has actually taught me that competition, global competition, is what over the long haul will make us better. I think it is the great disinfectant. I believe in competition as being the great disinfectant to making companies and economies better.
Thank you. Why not operate the New York Stock Exchange 724 and truly be the world's trading center and eliminate the time zone trading issues that we have today?
Where is he? Did you ask that question, Holly?
He's right there.
All right.
Malcolm.
I think that's going to happen. And there's a gentleman over here, John, who is better equipped to answer this question than I am, but I did grow up in the equity business. I'll give you my opinions. The New York Stock Exchange, as we have known it, what you see on TV, where you see people scurrying around on a floor, is going to cease to exist very soon. It will be an electronic market. There are aspects of that that actually make me very sad. I was very involved at the exchange at one time, never working on the floor, but working with the exchange. And there are aspects of human intervention in a stock market that I think can be very positive. But all that doesn't matter what I think. The bottom line is technology is going to be the key. And I think you will see a time, particularly the stock exchange has made some investments overseas. I think they would love to do something with the London Stock Exchange. The CEO of the London Stock Exchange is, I don't actually know what she's holding out for, but she seems to have a very strong point of view on what she's holding out for. But I could see a day when the exchange virtually, where if you want to trade a stock, there will be a way to do it 24 hours a day. One of the things, we'll get all my political leanings right out on the table here, you'll run me right out of town, but one of the things that I'm very concerned about actually is what has happened in Washington, D.C., particularly as it relates to certain aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley, and what has that done, on our competitiveness as a global capital accumulation center, New York, but really the United States. Look, I think we need strong regulation. And we were talking about over lunch the fact that every time I think that people in positions of responsibility have done every dumb thing that they can possibly do, we have IMUS, Dow Chemical, and apparently Paul Wolfowitz at the World Bank gave his girlfriend a raise last week. So people in business, people in government, people in the media, we all make our mistakes where we hand people a bat and then we're surprised they hit us. Having said that, I think that there are aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley that we should all be very concerned about. And it concerns me when I see more companies, private companies, that when it's time for them to go public, they list in London or in Europe as opposed to here in New York because the regulatory headache is just too high here. That concerns me.
Okay, and I'm going to pass this question because that came very close to answering it. I have two questions here that I'm going to combine. What risk do you see in the U.S. trade deficit looking ahead, and what impact does the U.S. debt have on the future economy?
Look, I think whether it's a government or a household, we were talking about the problem in the subprime lending market and the impact that that is having on the economy right now in the real estate market. Over the long haul, you have to have a budget that is balanced. That doesn't mean it has to be balanced every year or perfectly balanced every year, but if you run inefficiencies like that or imbalances like that over the long haul, it is going to hurt your global competitiveness. So we're at a very challenging time here now in the world, and the balance and the role that the Federal Reserve plays in monetary policy and the impact that has in the market, it's a very delicate balance. So I would not be somebody who would be an advocate of going to a balanced budget immediately, but over time, we have to get our financial house in order more than it is right now in the United States.
Thank you. Will China and India continue to grow rapidly? What do you see as possible constraints, if any?
I think China and India will continue to grow quite rapidly. At Merrill Lynch, we're very involved in India. I'll be there in the fall. We have, for 15 years, had a joint venture with a local Indian company called DSP. We own 40% of it. In December, we made that 90% of it. And we think India continues to be an attractive place and a growing place. Very well-educated citizens, a lot of work being outsourced there, and the outsourcing is going far beyond just a help desk or you have a problem with your credit card, you call there. Very sophisticated outsourcing going on to India right now, including things like certain aspects of research, financial research, a lot of the background work, crunching of numbers being done in India. I think China is fine through the Olympics in 2008. They're going to make sure that that is a show that works for the world. After that, I think there are some big issues there. I'll be in Hong Kong next week, as I mentioned. I was in Hong Kong last year, and I was appalled. I'm not a natural environmentalist, but I do care about the environment. I could not believe the quality of the air in Hong Kong, and it is all coming over from China. It was terrible. It actually burned my eyes. So they have challenges there. If you said, what are things that I think could inhibit those challenges? I talked earlier about the role that global capital markets interlinks economies, but it does more than that. It also gives people who historically perhaps did not get along a reason to get along. If you had some kind of geopolitical event there that broke down the level of cooperation, and in India in particular, despite all the great aspects of the Indian economy and the population that I talked about, their infrastructure is just so poor that I worry about what impact that will have eventually if it just takes us over the edge on that.
I'm going to give you this one quick. What is the entire name of Merrill Lynch? If you know.
I do. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. And at different times, there was Bean. He got the shaft. I don't quite understand. I want to end with a question that wasn't asked, but with these kids here, I want to make sure I'm going to ask it and answer it. I believe in education passionately. I was the first one in my family to go to college, and I went to a little college in West Virginia. My dad was a printer, and my mom worked in a department store, and that's typical of our company, where many of us are people who were the first ones in our family to go to college, our executive team that I just talked about. And I am very involved in the college that I went to and also TCU that I mentioned. I went to a little school in West Virginia called Bethany College. And quite often kids ask me, how did you decide where to go to college and what do you think is important about going to college and what should my major be? Because I want to be in business like you. By the way, I have two daughters. Cindy and I have two daughters, 16 and 19. They don't care at all about my opinion on this, but I got the stage, I flew all this way, I got to share with you. Seriously, for the kids. If there are mistakes that I see people make, they become so focused on the brand of the college and the national recognition of it. I will tell you that there are literally hundreds and hundreds of places in this country and other countries where you can get a great education. Find the right school for you. Not what your parents say, your friends say, or what you read in a magazine. The school I went to had 900 kids. It's well known in West Virginia. It changed my life. Because at that age, I was more interested in playing left field than I was going to economics class. And at Bethany, it was so small that when I missed class that freshman year, somebody called. That changed my life. So don't get hung up on, and look, Harvard's a great place, and I was lucky later in my life to spend some time there. But Harvard isn't for everybody, and you can get a great education at a place that isn't called Harvard. Second thing is, a lot of people think about their major, and they fret, and my daughter right now, who's a freshman in school, is torturing herself over her major. She's going to the School for Visual Arts in Manhattan, and she can't decide between, she knows she's going to be study fine arts, but she can't decide whether it should be photography or graphic arts. And she comes home every other weekend, tortures herself over it. I think one of the most overrated things and overblown out things is what is your major? Take interesting classes, classes that teach you how to think. And I think you will always benefit from any course that teaches you how to communicate, how to read and appreciate good writing, how to write in a way that you can communicate your thoughts to people, and to be able to stand up in front of people and speak in public. I think those are all important things. Frankly, whether you're an economics major or an accounting major or an education major, you will look back at age 30, which I know sounds old to you, but believe me, it's very young. And your major won't matter, but what you learn will always matter. Thank you for your time today.
All I can say to that last one is, where were you when I was 19 years old?